The financial media has been warning you about this so-called retail apocalypse for, well, the better part of a decade now.
Right.
But, I mean, if that narrative is entirely true, why on earth are developers frantically pouring $800 million into a single retail project in North Texas right now?
Yeah, it's a massive contradiction.
It really is. It forces you to rethink, you know, everything you thought you knew about commercial real estate.
It definitely does. On the surface, it's incredibly confusing. Because when you look at the landscape of commercial real estate at the end of July 2026, you see billions of dollars moving across the country, right?
Right.
You see these massive tenant expansions, but then simultaneous crushing distress in other sectors. And without a proper framework, those data points are basically just noise.
Just headlines.
Exactly. You really have to understand the underlying mechanics of where the capital is flowing, and more importantly, why it is just completely abandoning certain formats.
Well, welcome to the Deep Dive. Our mission today is to cut through that static. We are unpacking a towering stack of 50 different commercial real estate intelligence reports.
A lot of data.
Oh, it's a mountain. But we're extracting the actual signal to deliver actionable intelligence to position you for success. And we are able to do this because this deep dive is brought to you by Eureka Business Group.
The best in the business.
Absolutely. They are the premier authority and commercial real estate broker in the Dallas-Fort Worth market, specifically specializing in retail. They navigate this exact landscape every single day. And today, well, we are sharing that roadmap with you. So let's start by outlining the terrain.
Yeah, so the terrain right now is defined by four major shifts. First, we have this explosive leasing velocity and development wave, heavily concentrated in the Dallas-Fort Worth area.
Huge growth there.
Massive. Second, there is a stark, honestly, almost violent divergence in the capital markets. We're seeing huge success in open-air retail, contrasted against just severe distress for legacy enclosed malls.
Like night and day.
Completely. Third, you have the immense pressure of the 1031 exchange timeline, and that's colliding with an incredibly unforgiving debt market right now.
That's a tightrope.
It is. And finally, shifting consumer habits, along with some intense supply chain pressures, are forcing retailers to, you know, completely rewrite their physical footprints.
Okay, let's start on Eureka Business Group's home turf, because the concentration of growth and capital flowing into North Texas is just... No, it's impossible to ignore.
It really is.
The DFW retail market right now, it basically looks like a game of musical chairs. But instead of removing chairs, developers are just frantically building more to keep up with tenant demand.
That is a perfect analogy.
Take the Fields West mixed-use development in Frisco by Carahan Companies. This is an $800 million project.
Mind-blowing numbers.
Right. But I have to ask, with construction costs and interest rates where they are today, isn't pouring $800 million into a ground-up build just a massive speculative gamble?
Well, see, it would be a gamble if it were speculative, but it's actually a highly calculated, heavily de-risked play.
How so?
The retail component of Fields West is roughly 360,000 square feet, right?
Yeah.
And it is already approximately 75% pre-leased.
Wow. Before it's even built.
Exactly. They are not waiting to build it to see who shows up. They've already secured premium experiential brands. We're talking Lululemon, Warby Parker, Tecovas.
Heavy hitters.
Right. And when a developer secures that level of commitment from credit tenants before the foundation is even finished, it provides this massive verified demand signal for those high-income North Dallas corridors. The capital just follows the guaranteed foot traffic.
That makes total sense.
Yeah.
And it's not just ground-up dirt being developed either. We are seeing massive capital injected into legacy sites just to bring them up to this new experiential standard.
Oh, for sure.
Down in Arlington, Trademark Property Company is executing a $135 million redevelopment of the former Lincoln Square.
Huge project.
Yeah, turning it into Anthem, which is this 43-acre retail, dining, and entertainment district. They already have 35,000 square feet of additional space in final lease negotiations.
The demand is just relentless.
It is. Plus, the regional tenants are expanding aggressively. You've got Frisco-based Lane's Chicken Fingers hitting 50 operating units with 24 new franchise agreements.
And don't forget Gongcha.
Right. Gongcha is executing a 50-unit development deal across major Texas metros. But, I mean, if you are a private investor listening to this, you probably do not have $800 million to build a lifestyle center.
Probably not.
So how do you actually play this demand?
Well, you let the massive institutional developers spend the $800 million to draw the crowd, and you capture the spillover.
The spillover.
Exactly. Acquiring nearby service retail or restaurant assets is a highly strategic move right now. You position yourself to capture the halo effect of that newly created customer base.
I see.
Yeah, the strategic buyer looks for necessity-oriented assets. Think like a dry cleaner, a dental office, or a quick service restaurant in a strip center just a mile down the road from Fields West or Anthem.
Because the traffic is already there.
Right. You serve the exact same affluent customer base that is already driving to the area for the high-end apparel, but you acquire the asset at a much, much more accessible price point.
But wait, let me push back on that for a second.
Sure.
If everyone in the market knows that open-air, necessity-based retail is the winner right now, aren't those assets getting incredibly overpriced? Like, if the secret is out, how does a buyer actually find yield in this environment without completely overpaying?
That's the million-dollar question, and it brings us directly to the macro capital markets. It explains why understanding the format of retail is really the only way to underwrite risk today.
Format being the keyword.
Right. You are absolutely right that open-air assets command a premium, but it's a liquidity premium that the market is willing to pay for safety.
Okay, walk me through that.
Just look at the institutional flow of funds. Brixmor Property Group just acquired the Mayfair Shopping Center in New York for $70
million. $70
million. Yep. That is a 221,000-square-foot center anchored by Little Planet Fitness and PGA Tour Superstore. And down in Atlanta, Sterling Organization purchased the Whole Foods-anchored Merchants Walk for $93.2 million.
Okay, so why are they dropping nearly $100 million on a grocery-anchored center? What does a Whole Foods actually do to the valuation of, say, the nail salon or the pet store next door?
It creates predictable, recession-resistant frequency.
Frequency.
Exactly. A grocery anchor forces the consumer to visit that specific property two or three times a week, basically regardless of the broader economic climate. People always need groceries.
Right. You can't skip buying food.
Exactly. And that guaranteed foot traffic subsidizes the success of the inline tenants, the nail salon, the coffee shop. The liquidity premium exists because lenders and institutional buyers know that the cash flow from a grocery-anchored center is exponentially more secure than purely discretionary retail.
So you pay more up front, but you sleep better at night.
Bingo. That security drives up the purchase price, but it dramatically lowers the risk profile.
And if you want to understand why investors are paying a premium for that security, well, you just have to look at the alternative. Because the commercial mortgage-backed securities data for enclosed malls is, I mean, it's grim.
It's terrifying, honestly.
The late July metrics indicate that enclosed mall loans originated in 2016 or earlier currently have a 96.3% delinquency rate.
96%. Let that sink in.
It is staggering. And real-world fallout is happening right now. A $49.3 million loan on New York's Sangertown Square Mall just moved to special servicing. And locally in DFW, JCPenney has confirmed they are permanently closing their store at Ridgemar Mall in Fort Worth on November 1st. So the media's whole retail apocalypse thing, it wasn't entirely wrong, it's just heavily misapplied. We're looking at a format apocalypse.
Precisely. And Globus reporting explicitly confirms this. Retail CMBS performance is now divided entirely by property format.
You can't just group it all together anymore.
You can't. You absolutely cannot treat all retail debt as a single risk category. The risk is heavily concentrated in weaker, obsolete, enclosed malls.
And when you say a loan moves to special servicing, what does that actually mean on the ground?
When an asset moves to special servicing, it essentially means the borrower is in default or imminent default. A third party steps in to figure out how to salvage the lender's capital.
Which is never a good sign.
No, it often precedes foreclosure or a major fire sale. That 96% delinquency rate on vintage mall loans proves that the enclosed, department store reliant format is fundamentally broken for the modern consumer.
I am thinking about the collateral damage here, though. Like, if JCPenney closes at Ridgemar Mall, what happens to the investor who owns that unglamorous strip mall across the street that we were just talking about? Does their foot traffic just evaporate overnight?
It absolutely can, which is why underwriting requires extreme vigilance right now.
You have to pay attention.
You do. If you own or are looking to buy property near a distressed enclosed mall, you have to rigorously model traffic displacement. When a major anchor vanishes, it alters the driving patterns for the entire immediate submarket.
That makes sense.
But honestly, the more hidden danger lies in co-tenancy clauses.
Oh, break that down for us. How does a co-tenancy clause actually weaponize a mall's failure against a neighboring landlord?
It's a huge blind spot for some buyers. Many sophisticated smaller tenants have provisions in their leases stating that if a major anchor like a JCPenney or a Macy's leaves the adjacent property, or if the overall center's occupancy drops below a certain percentage, that smaller tenant legally has the right to pay a heavily reduced rent. Or, in some cases, break their lease entirely and just walk away.
So the shockwave of an anchor leaving does not stop at the property line.
Exactly. If you are not auditing the lease language of your surrounding tenants, a distressed mall next door can literally bankrupt your fully leased strip center.
That structural distress in the mall sector creates a massive psychological trap for buyers. Because when investors get spooked by 96% delinquency rates, they rush towards safe, passive assets.
They want a safe harbor.
Right. Which brings us to the ticking time bomb of the 1031 exchange.
Yes. The 1031 exchange is a powerful tax deferral mechanism. It allows an investor to sell a property and roll the capital gains into a new property without paying immediate taxes.
But there's a catch.
A huge catch. The IRS mandates a strict 45-day identification period and a 180-day completion period. And wealth advisors across all our sources are issuing stark warnings. These deadlines cannot be extended.
Wait, let me stop you there. What if your bank drags its feet on the appraisal, or, you know, environmental testing takes an extra 3 weeks?
The IRS does not care about your underwriting delays.
No exception.
None. If you miss day 45 or day 180, your exchange fails, and you are hit with the massive capital gains tax bill immediately.
Ouch.
Yeah, that ticking clock turns a rational investment process into a high-stakes pressure cooker.
Which completely explains why we are seeing buyers target very specific passive replacement properties, especially in DFW.
Exactly.
Like we saw the sale of the India Bazaar Plaza in Little Elm. This is a fully leased, multi-tenant, triple-net asset. We also see JLL securing financing for Cornerstone Plaza, which is a fully leased 8-tenant shopping center in Southlake. Lenders and 1031 buyers are clearly prioritizing stabilized suburban retail in affluent submarkets.
And you see this trend extend to the national single-tenant net lease, or STNL, market too. Mm. There's a recent $11.8 million sale of an LA Fitness in California with about 8 years left on its lease. We also saw a $6 million sale of the Upland Square retail pad in Pennsylvania. That one features an Aspen Dental, Starbucks, and Chili's.
Okay, but why a gym? LA Fitness for almost $12 million seems heavy for a single tenant. Why is that the safe harbor for a time-constrained 1031 buyer?
Because a gym operates as a highly defensive asset.
Defensive how?
It requires physical presence. You know, you cannot stream a bench press over the internet.
True.
Furthermore, these assets typically feature triple net leases. That means the tenant, not the landlord, is responsible for paying the property taxes, insurance, and maintenance.
That's very hands-off.
Extremely. For an investor trying to beat a 45-day clock and secure a passive income stream, a long-term triple net lease to a national brand with a localized, sticky customer base is incredibly attractive.
But here is the massive hurdle with that strategy today. Current commercial mortgage rates are hovering around, what, 6.37% for net lease properties?
Yeah.
And 6.77% for shopping centers?
Yeah.
At the same time, the Treasury yield curve suggests we are not seeing a rapid return to cheap debt anytime soon.
We are definitely not.
So if your debt costs are hovering in the high sixes, how do you avoid the trap of rushing into a bad deal just to beat that IRS deadline?
The biggest risk for a 1031 buyer today is the temptation to accept weak lease economics just to satisfy that tax deadline. To survive this environment, you must understand and stress test your positive leverage.
Meaning the property actually has to out-earn the cost of the money you borrowed to buy it.
Exactly. Your going-in cap rate, which is essentially the annual yield the property generates based on its purchase price, well, it must be higher than your interest rate.
Right.
If you are paying 6.7% to the bank, but the property only yields a 5.5% cap rate, you are experiencing negative leverage.
Which is bad.
It's terrible. You are literally paying for the privilege to own the building. You cannot underwrite a deal today, assuming that cap rates will magically compress or that you can simply refinance your way out of negative leverage in 2 years.
So preparation has to start long before the clock starts ticking. You cannot let the tax tail wag the investment dog.
Perfectly said. The advisors stress that you must treat the exchange as a coordinated operation. You need to assemble your team, your intermediary, your lender, your tax advisor, and your broker at Eureka Business Group well before your relinquished property even goes under contract.
Get the ducks in a row.
Exactly. You need executable alternatives identified early. That way, you are negotiating from a position of analytical strength rather than desperation on day 44.
That makes the mechanics clear, but look, all of this real estate underwriting ultimately relies on one thing: the tenant's ability to pay rent.
Always.
And their ability to pay rent relies entirely on the American consumer. The operational strategies of these retailers are shifting rapidly because consumer realities are shifting.
The intelligence reports paint a really vivid picture of a consumer base under serious pressure.
Just look at the back-to-school metrics. Shoppers are heavily prioritizing absolute essentials, like school supplies and technology, over apparel.
Right. Kids' apparel unit demand was forecast to fall approximately 3%.
And more tellingly, a staggering 45% of surveyed households plan to use buy now, pay later financing just to manage their back-to-school purchases.
That is a massive red flag.
It is. It's a glaring indicator that household liquidity and discretionary income are weakening.
And then on the retailer side, rising freight rates are hitting a four-year high.
But wait, if I am a landlord and I am looking at a tenant's top-line sales and they look stable, why should I care what they're paying for freight?
Because rent is paid out of net operating margins, not gross revenue.
Ah, okay.
If a tenant relies heavily on imported goods and their supply chain costs suddenly double due to four-year highs in freight rates, their profit margin evaporates.
It's just gone.
Exactly. And if they lack the pricing power to pass those increased costs on to that already squeezed consumer we just talked about, they will eventually default on their lease, regardless of how busy their store looks.
Wow.
Yeah, you have to underwrite their supply chain exposure, not just their foot traffic.
Yeah. You can see this divergence in brand performance immediately. I mean, Crocs just hit $1 billion in quarterly revenue for the first time ever.
Incredible quarter for them.
Meanwhile, Vans saw their revenue drop 8%. And then Adidas saw their apparel sales jump an incredible 34%.
The divergence is wild.
It is volatile. And it is forcing retailers to get incredibly creative with their physical footprints to protect their margins. Like, Ross Dress for Less is pushing ahead with 110 new store openings in 2026.
They're expanding fast.
Very fast. And down in McAllen, Texas, David's Bridal is testing a hybrid outlet shop-in-shop inside their existing store. They're trying to capture a more price-conscious consumer without taking on the massive liability of signing a new lease for a separate building.
And how this filters down to the landlord's strategy is where the market gets truly dynamic.
How so?
Well, when you have shifting consumer spending and major brands radically rethinking their square footage requirements, the leasing strategy has to adapt instantly.
It honestly looks like a high-stakes game of real-life Tetris.
Tetris, exactly.
Landlords are staring at these massive, sometimes awkward, empty blocks of space left behind by defunct legacy retailers. And we are seeing landlords get highly creative, dropping discount apparel into old department stores and electronics into defunct craft stores, just trying to clear the lines and keep their centers generating yield.
It's all about yield.
Right. Look at Burlington taking over a massive 93,000 square foot former Kohl's in a New York mall. Or Best Buy right-sizing into an 18,000 square foot former Michael's space in Connecticut.
That Tetris analogy perfectly captures the current leasing environment. Off-price retailers, you know, like Ross and Burlington, they're currently the strongest replacement candidates for those large vacant boxes.
Because they fit the current consumer.
Exactly. They cater perfectly to that squeezed, price-conscious consumer we just identified. But look closer at Best Buy.
Taking the smaller space.
Right. Taking an 18,000 square foot box, which is less than half the size of their legacy stores, that proves a fundamental shift. Retailers no longer need massive showrooms to hold inventory.
They just need fulfillment hubs, basically.
Pretty much. They are using smaller footprints optimized for buy online, pick up in-store logistics. There is robust demand for these right-sized spaces, allowing landlords to carve up obsolete big boxes into multiple higher-paying, smaller footprints.
It is a complete recalibration of how space is valued.
Yeah.
So, as we synthesize this massive stack of intelligence, the takeaways are incredibly concrete for you.
Yes, they are.
The Dallas-Fort Worth market remains an absolute powerhouse, particularly for open-air and necessity-based retail. But you cannot blindly buy into this market.
No, that's a recipe for disaster.
You have to aggressively stress test tenant supply chain costs, not just top line sales. You must rigorously check co-tenancy clauses to protect yourself from legacy mall distress. And if you are executing a 1031 exchange, you have to ensure your going in cap rate provides positive leverage against elevated debt costs before that 45-day clock expires.
This market is punishing to the unprepared, but highly lucrative for those who actually understand the mechanics. Execution requires a level of precision that makes having the right advisory team absolutely non-negotiable.
Which is exactly why this deep dive was brought to you by Eureka Business Group. If you are navigating the Dallas-Fort Worth market, they are the premier commercial real estate retail brokerage equipped to help you capitalize on the specific trends we unpacked today. Now, before we sign off, we want to leave you with one final thread to pull on.
Yeah, buried in the reports was a small but potentially massive news item about CC Vending and Coca-Cola partnering to bring automated retail to New York subway locations.
Okay, vending machines.
Right. But it points to a growing normalization of unattended, small footprint retail in high traffic areas.
Oh, I see where you're going with this.
It raises a fascinating question for the future of commercial real estate. If automated retail continues to scale, could shopping center owners soon start monetizing their literal walkways and the dead space in their parking lots as high margin, zero build out retail environments? Could the simple concrete between the grocery store and your car completely redefine what we consider leasable square footage over the next 5 years?
Suddenly, every square inch of the property becomes a potential revenue-generating asset. The rules of the game are always changing, and what looks like static on the surface is actually the sound of a market evolving. Thank you for joining us as we cut through the noise on this deep dive. Keep looking for the signal, and we will see you next time.